Then I get bumped from Backlash. I'm not good enough to call Backlash.
This is your friendly reminder that it's been 14 years and Joey Styles still isn't good enough to call Backlash.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
It's not hot. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Poor Joey Styles. Can't catch a break even after all these years. You would think they'd bring the guy in for Backlash. But I guess he's going to have to wait another year. This is episode 656 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, June 14, 2020. I am the Solid Monster. It is Backlash Sunday tonight on pay-per-view. For those of you who missed the predictions that went up, it was live on YouTube on Friday. I'm going to run through them, give you the Cliff Notes version here in a little bit. We'll talk about that. Also, don't forget that today is the Undertaker Last Ride Chapter 4 drop on WWE Network. They took a couple of weeks off, and the latest episode, Chapter 4, is now available on WWE Network. I plan on watching it, doing my review, and it should be ready to go by Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern. That's what we've been doing each week. So Tuesday night, 8 o'clock, I hope you'll all join me on YouTube for my Last Ride recap. You want to support this podcast, one of the ways you can do so is by using our Audible link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Sign up for a 30-day trial of the service. You get one free audiobook of your choosing, and there's so many different ones that you guys can choose from. So many wrestling books, right? I've talked about the death of WCW. I've talked about Nitro, which is all about the Nitro years. Some pretty cool accounts and interviews with Turner executives and people on the inside talking about the rise and fall of WCW. A lot of praise for Hornswoggle, Dylan Postal, his new book, right? Life is Short, I believe, is the name of the book. Anyway, whatever book you choose, you can get it for free. Just use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. And even if you cancel your trial before the 30 days are up, you get to keep the book no matter what. You want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on this very show. I have to show my love and support for all of my listeners, and we have people who've been listening since episode 1, back in 2007, and we're also getting new donators and supporters every week who are donating or listening for the very first time, so I appreciate everybody's support, whoever you may be. I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool, James Herrera, the Florida Freebird, Brian Pissera, Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Eugene Crazy Ass Morgan, used to be Crazy Eyes. He has since had a gimmick change. He's now Crazy Ass. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Stephen Handyman Halistic, Billy Hardcore Habibi, John the Shooter Stockton, DeVenom John Iru, the Chicago Screamer, Ian Noel Camelotes, thank you Ian, Cut Him Up Casey Dominey, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Maniac Moderator Jeff Lippman, and the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep. We're going to have more shoutouts coming. If you didn't hear your name, don't worry, got to spread them out a little bit. But I also want to mention this, WrestleRumble.com is giving away not one, not two, but three. Yes, three replica championship belts to one very lucky winner in its Big Three Belt Bash Winner Take All. And it all goes down tonight. All it takes is one entry, but you can enter as many times as you want. It's only $1. $1 to enter. That's it. For a buck, you could take home the ECW World Title, the big gold WCW heavyweight title, and my favorite, the classic Winged Eagle WWE Championship, all for just $1 if you're lucky enough to be chosen, and I get to pick the winner tonight live during my Backlash stream after the pay-per-view is over. So you still have time to enter if you are listening to this here earlier in the day on Sunday. Entries can be purchased up until 7 o'clock tonight, Eastern Time. just go to WrestleRumble.com. Man, I'm all nervous. You know, normally we pick a few different winners or somebody wins a belt. I mean, this is the biggest giveaway they've done. It's all resting on my shoulders. I gotta get these nerves under control. So go ahead and apply and we'll have some fun tonight on the stream. Another week, another wrestling death. This week it was one of the most famous mass wrestlers of all time, Johnny Walker, better known as Mr. Wrestling 2, who passed away at the age of 85. He began wrestling back in the mid-50s, had his most famous run as Mr. Wrestling 2, in the 70s into the 1980s. Huge star in the Georgia territory, multiple-time world champion down there, 10 times, in fact. If you were he was the Charlotte Flair of Georgia. If you were a fan of wrestling on TBS back in the day, if you're old enough to remember those days, mid to late 70s, early 80s, you saw Mr. Wrestling too. No doubt about it. I don't know if you were a fan of his, but you definitely saw him. You knew who he was. Probably were a fan of his work. He did spend a couple of years in the mid 80s working in the WWE. But he was near the, he was older. He was near the end of his career at that point. They really didn't do anything with him. President Jimmy Carter, this is the famous story. President Carter and his mother, they were huge fans of Mr. Wrestling 2. His mother once invited him over to her house. And they just sat in a room all by themselves for about 2 hours, just talking. I guess talking about life, talking about wrestling. She was the one who famously invited him to attend her son's presidential inauguration, but he declined because the Secret Service agents would have forced him to unmask, and he wasn't willing to do that. I mean, this guy wore his mask everywhere. You know, the only place he said he never wore it to was restaurants because it made it hard for him to chew his food. You know, I don't even think he allowed anyone to film him without his mask on until an interview that he did. Might have been at some wrestling convention. It's up on YouTube. Interview that he did with Bill Apter from 2010. That might have been the first time he allowed somebody on camera to film him without his mask on. The man kept kayfabe, you know, especially back then. That's the era that he was from. You kept kayfabe. You protected your identity. You protected the wrestling business. Very old school. But all that being said, because I do think that this is something that should not be swept under the rug and ignored. It, you know, if you're talking about the man's life, then you talk about the man's life. I was not even aware of this until, later in the week, you know, when somebody had called into the Dynamite stream on Wednesday and they asked me a question during the... it wasn't even a... I don't even know if it was a question or a super chat, but whatever it was, somebody had asked me. On Wednesday, during the stream, they said, oh, what are your thoughts on the passing of Mr. Wrestling 2? And I gave very brief thoughts. I said, well, I'll talk more about him on Sunday. But honestly, I was not really a fan at that time. He's a little before my time, so I wasn't over... I knew who he was. I was not overly familiar with his work, and so I didn't really have, you know, a personal opinion one way or the other. But when I was kind of looking into his background and all of his different accomplishments and everything, I was stunned when at the end of one of his bios, might have been on his Wikipedia page, almost as like an afterthought, just kind of stuck right there, tacked on to the end, was this item that just made my jaw drop, and I had to go look for verification of this, and I found it. And I found the verification on the sex offender registry, including his photo and his birth year. So it is him. Then I found some newspaper clippings from the time when Walker was 18 years old. He was arrested in connection with the gang rape of a 15-year-old girl in Hawaii. This is back in 1953. He was one of 9 suspects arrested, 4 adults and 5 juveniles. That was a very disturbing thing to find out. I did not know this. I could not find any information on whether or not he was convicted or... it looks like he may have pleaded down to a lesser charge. He obviously had to register as a sex offender, so it wasn't like he was let off the hook. I mean, that follows you around for the rest of your life. even says on the offender registry, you know, last time the person checked in, you got to keep your photos updated. You know, the photo of him up there is a relatively recent photo. He's an old man, you know, so obviously something happened here. Or there was some sort of plea or something that was reached, but I believe he actually retired to Hawaii. I think he was living in Hawaii when he passed away. It's part of his life story. It's part of his life story. It's not something that should just be ignored or overlooked. You know, no one is denying that he was absolutely a legendary name in the wrestling business, but I, you know, did not really see it mentioned hardly anywhere until, you know, after the fact. And then, you know, some people started mentioning it. And then in some of the bios, it was mentioned. But that was a very big surprise to learn that about his past. But again, when you're talking about somebody's life, it's fair game. You know, people will choose to remember him the way that they choose to remember him. I'm sure a lot of people who watched him on TV back in the day are going to have very fond memories of Mr. Wrestling, and that's fine. You know, because that's what they know of him. But this is also a part of his past, and like I said, it's not the sort of thing that should just be swept under the rug as if it didn't happen. Tonight is WWE Backlash. I will be live on YouTube immediately following the show to recap it all, and, as I mentioned, to pick a winner in the winner-take-all Wrestle Rumble contest. I did a nearly two-hour stream on Friday, running down the card with my predictions, taking some calls at the end. Also with my thoughts mixed in on Monday Night Raw, which I'm not going to get into, you know, in review form, because I've already talked about it, and I'll touch a little bit on it here. But if you missed it, if you got some time before the pay-per-view, want to kill some time, go back and check it out. But I will run through the predictions really quickly here. We have the new women's tag team champions, Sasha Banks and Bayley, defending their titles against Nikki Cross and Alexa Bliss, and the Iconics, both of whom are former champions. I don't understand the Iconics being in this match. I don't understand what they've done to be part of this match. You know, Nikki and Alexa, I can understand because they just lost them. But they wanted, I guess, to kind of shoehorn them in there. Who knows? Maybe they'll win. Maybe it'll be some kind of fluky finish and the Iconics will get the belts back and the belts will be right back in the doldrums where they were before when they held them the last time. I don't think putting the belts on Sasha and Bayley was a long-term thing, but putting them right back on Nikki and Alexa makes no sense. Makes very little sense. And I don't want to see the Iconics with them. Now, Sasha and Bayley, they're my pick to retain, but we did learn that on Wednesday, this Wednesday on NXT, whoever the women's tag team champions are coming out of the show, they are scheduled to defend the titles against Tegan Nox and Shotzi Blackheart on NXT. I say Sasha and Bayley retain here. They go to NXT on Wednesday. Do the upset. Let Tegan and Shotzi win the belts off of them, off of a miscommunication between Sasha and Bayley. So that way it advances their story, right? Pushes them a little bit closer to the brink, which is clearly what all of this is building to. And, you know, it's like a, you kind of have the shock win for Tegan and Shotzi. Let them travel a little bit to each brand. Let them bring some, maybe a little bit of prestige to the titles, defending them in NXT. Going to be fighting champions. That's what I would do. That's what I would do. We have Jeff Hardy taking on Sheamus. Now, the build to this match has been kind of controversial. Not everybody likes it. I'm not thrilled with it, but I at least understood the story they were trying to tell a few weeks ago when they did the whole angle with the car accident and Elias got taken out. Apparently, Elias really does have a torn pec muscle, which is one of the injuries they listed for him. So I don't know if that means he's having surgery. You know, either way, that's an injury that's going to keep him on the shelf for at least a few months. So, sucks to be him, kind of like Jinder Mahal. Jinder Mahal just came back, and he was having some knee problems. He went back under the knife. It was only supposed to be a minor surgery, and they found, I guess, more extensive damage. And it turned into a major surgery. So, Jinder Mahal, he comes back, right back on the shelf. Elias had an injury before, comes back, right back on the shelf. Boy, these empty arena shows are really taking it out of some of these guys. But they did that whole angle, the drunk driving thing, and, you know, arresting Jeff, and then he took the test, and he passed the sobriety test, and, you know, I kind of, I don't want to say excused it, but I at least, when I was talking about it a few weeks ago, there was a justification for it. Tasteless as it may have been, there was a justification for it. And then I heard rumors of this go-home angle that was taped for the SmackDown show on Friday. Talked a little bit about it on the stream on Friday, and I said, well, let's just wait and see. Let's see how it plays out. It sounds horrendous, but let's see how it plays out on TV. And so, sure enough, the report was accurate. The report from Sportskeeda, credit to them, it was accurate, and Sheamus comes out with a doctor and these lab technicians, and he comes out and he wants them, they're going to administer a rapid response urine test right there in the ring to Jeff Hardy, because he wants assurances that Jeff can pass a drug test before he will agree to sign the contract to wrestle him at Backlash. Which, by the way, by the time this segment was over, I don't recall Sheamus ever signing the contract. I know Jeff did. I never saw Sheamus, though, sign the contract. But they did a segment, everybody's been pointing this out, and in fact they did. They did do a segment like this one once before. Back in, it had to be 2006, I'm guessing, with Shawn Michaels and Vince McMahon on Monday Night Raw. But when I say that they did a segment like this before, I feel like I have to be more specific. They didn't do a segment like this before. They did this exact segment before. They copied it right down to the verbiage. Word for word. There's a part of this segment here where Sheamus, as Jeff is doing his business, pissing into a cup or a jar. Sheamus, to divert our attention away from that, looks into the camera and he says, if you're a user, you're a loser. Don't do drugs. And then Jeff, just like Shawn Michaels did all those many years ago, grabs the piss cup, with again, the jar, and says, well, it's better to be pissed off than pissed on. And he splashes it right in Sheamus' face. By the way, Shawn Michaels did a hell of a job, a hell of a better job than Jeff Hardy did. Now, look, can you really blame Jeff Hardy if his heart wasn't into this stupid segment? Just because Shawn Michaels did a good job with it back in 06 doesn't mean it was a great segment then either. Vince McMahon has this thing for toilet humor, urine humor, shit falling from the ceiling. He's a 5-year-old boy in the body of a nearly 75-year-old man. We know this already. This is the kind of humor that just gets his jollies going, warms his cockles. So I watched this, and then I watched the other segment, and I was blown away by the fact that they didn't even try to change it. Awful. Awful. I've heard of recycling storylines before. Everybody does it. But it's not very often that you just see a segment with just such blatant laziness where they think, let's just do this. Or, even worse, they think, man, you know, that's a great classic segment of all the great segments to bring back and to recycle. Let's go with that one. Let's do that one. Anyway, Sheamus is going to win. He's my pick. Apollo Crews, he defends the United States Championship against the former champion Andrade, who won a number one contender's triple threat match on Raw Monday night. He beat Angel Garza and Kevin Owens. Kevin Owens had the match won. Andrade knocked him out of the way, and he got the pin on his, I don't know if they're buddies, but his stablemate. Zelina Vega's other client, Angel Garza, so that's going to cause some issues. In fact, I think it could cause some issues tonight. I think Angel Garza may come out to quote-unquote help, and it could backfire, and that could be what costs Andrade the match. I think Apollo Crews retains. We have Asuka defending her Raw Women's Championship against Nia the Destroyer. And ever since Nia Jax came back, they booked her like a monster, and I said this on Friday, poor Kairi Sane has paid a price for it. She's a little worse for wear coming out of her matches with Nia Jax, but they wanted her to kind of just beat people up and just be this dominant force. And so here we are now, and I don't think Asuka is dropping the championship. I just hope we don't get interference from anybody, you know, Shayna Baszler or Charlotte Flair. I want Asuka to beat Nia Jax decisively. If you're going to build to Asuka and Charlotte, if you're going to build to Asuka and Shayna Baszler, give her a dominant win. It could be a come-from-behind win, but she still has to show dominance. It should be a decisive victory here in this match for Asuka. The two of them have had matches going back to their NXT days that I remember as being, you know, fairly good. So there could be some chemistry there. They could end up having a good match. potentially they could end up having a good match. But now that the NXT Championship is off of Charlotte, we saw her actually pin Asuka on television this past Monday night, thanks to the interference or the distraction by Nia Jax. That would seem to set things in motion for Charlotte to challenge next for the championship, maybe at the July pay-per-view. I would prefer that Charlotte be the stopgap, or just the next in line, to pave the way for somebody else at SummerSlam, that somebody else being Shayna Baszler. But I'm sure they're going to want Charlotte involved in a big match at SummerSlam, so maybe Charlotte is the opponent, or maybe that's a triple threat. I don't know. There's a lot of changes going on behind the scenes of Monday Night Raw that could actually affect the way things play out, and it could affect people directly, like Shayna Baszler. And I'm going to get into that in a little bit, that big story of the week. But I do see Asuka winning. I do not see her losing the championship, and she should not lose the championship. Braun Strowman defends the Universal title in a handicap match against The Miz and John Morrison in a handicap match against the former tag team champions. Hate matches like this. You can get away with doing it on TV, but to book this as your championship match on pay-per-view just tells you that they said, well, we don't have anybody better. We don't have anybody better, so let's, you know, Braun's a big monster. Let's put him in the ring with two guys instead of one. And it'll make him look dominant. We don't have Bray Wyatt. Bray Wyatt went and had another little Bray baby. He's been off with JoJo. Obviously, he's coming back. He could be back as soon as tonight. And obviously, the direction is going to be Braun Strowman and The Fiend. It has to be. You know, Mr. Rogers Bray, Funhouse Bray lost, but what about The Fiend? You know, The Fiend is going to be lurking somewhere, so if we don't see him or hear his voice tonight, I'm almost positive we will by Friday night. And once they get him back, I'm sure they're going to resume the program between the two, and we may well see The Fiend get the championship back. I mean, the idea that you would resume the feud, Bray lost, then you're going to have The Fiend lose? I mean, based on some of the things they've done with The Fiend, I suppose I wouldn't be terribly shocked, but I don't see that happening. I think that title may wind up right back on The Fiend. But in order for that to happen, Braun has to win here. So Braun Strowman is my pick. We don't need no Freebird rule with the Universal title. We've already got that with the tag team titles, right? With New Day, before Xavier got hurt. We don't need that here. Drew McIntyre defends the WWE Championship against the almighty Bobby Lashley. They have woken up, I guess, and started to make Bobby Lashley into this destroyer on TV after doing a lot of comedy stuff with him and the stuff with Lana, who's still hanging around. And Lana may be the key to this match here, because I don't see Bobby Lashley winning the title. I would not take the title off Drew McIntyre. I wouldn't do it. I think it's too soon. I think it's premature. I think it would be a mistake. Keep that championship on Drew. But I also don't think you necessarily want to just kind of beat Bobby Lashley decisively and he goes back to the scrap heap or anything like that. I think there could still be value in him or a match with Brock Lesnar eventually. So what do you do? And I know it's kind of cheap, but you get Lana involved. Lana comes down to the ring. She's not supposed to be down there. Bobby Lashley doesn't want her down there. She somehow factors into this finish, leads to a claymore, and Drew McIntyre wins. And the hope is that that then leads to divorce between Bobby Lashley and Lana so we could finally end this terrible, stupid storyline. That, to me, would be the ideal situation. That way you keep the belt on Drew, Lashley has a built-in excuse for why he lost, and he can go Splitsville with Lana. Everybody wins, except Lana, but everybody wins. I win. As a viewer, I win in that scenario. And in what may be the greatest wrestling match ever, Edge takes on Randy Orton. Takes on Randall Keith Orton. This match was taped a week ago, same day as NXT TakeOver. They taped it before TakeOver, which was smart because they wanted to have the crowd as energetic and as fresh as possible. So they made sure that that match was taped in front of probably the first match of the day at, I guess, Full Sail, right? I mean, if they did it at TakeOver, then that means the match was taped at Full Sail, I guess, and not the PC. Edge did an interview with ESPN this week. He talked about the whole tagline. He said at first he thought it was a joke. He thought it was a rib. Then he realized very quickly that it was not. That, you know, Vince McMahon and Paul Heyman, they were serious about this. I mean, let's be honest. Vince McMahon, it was his idea. I don't believe for a second that this was Paul Heyman's idea. This was Paul Heyman backing up his boss. This was not Paul Heyman's idea. This is a Vince McMahon idea to a T. And so he realized that they were serious, and he said, look, if it were up to me, no, we would not be promoting this match as the greatest anything, because that's not, as a performer, what you want to do. You don't want to put that kind of pressure on yourself going into it. You don't want to set the bar so high that it can't be met, because, and he made a great point here, there is no such thing as the greatest match ever. There are great matches, there are classic matches, there are matches that you and I may think are the greatest ever, but there is no such thing as the greatest match ever. It is completely subjective, and I can't sit here and tell you that I have seen every professional wrestling match that has ever been contested. So how can I say for sure that any one match is the greatest match ever? The whole concept of it is dumb, but it's a promotional tactic. It is a purely promotional tactic. Does it work? I guess we'll find out. If we find out that they got, you know, 300,000 new network subscribers, which they won't, I almost guarantee you, not for that reason they won't. But if it works, then hey, kudos. Vince McMahon, he knew what he was doing. I don't see that happening. But it is the one match on this card that people are talking about. Now the thing about that is, there aren't a lot of matches to talk about on this show. This could turn out to be a very good pay-per-view, but it's not like there's that other one match where it's like, oh man, I can't wait to see that match. Oh, we're going to get a Daniel Bryan, AJ Styles rematch or something like that. Of course, this is the match people are talking about because it's the only match on the show that really has been made to feel, I guess, big in any way. But they've turned it almost into this cartoony thing. It's not even a personal issue anymore. Edge and Christian and Orton, they did the best they could on Monday night. They had a peep show segment. Christian came back. I enjoyed the segment overall. I thought they did well. They tried. You know, they tried as much as they could. Christian was trying to kind of psych up his boy, his friend. But there's only so much you could do. This whole thing has been one giant corporate slogan. I've got Randy Orton for the win. I mean, it just seems to me this match is tailor-made for a Randy Orton victory. Edge took the win at WrestleMania. This may not be the last match between these two, but even if it is, you know, this whole greatest wrestling match ever tagline. You know, some of the people in this company talk about Randy Orton like he walks on water. Oh my God, he's so smart in the ring. He's one of the greats, the all-time greats. Well, Orton's the heel. It would make more sense for him to walk around talking about how I won the greatest wrestling match ever. Doesn't sound like something Edge would go around and do. I mean, hell, he's giving interviews saying he didn't even want to call it that in the first place. So I think it makes, and for another reason too, for another reason it makes sense for Randy Orton to win. Because coming out of this match, you know, you're looking ahead, who can challenge Drew McIntyre for the WWE Championship? Who are his opponents on the horizon? If Jinder Mahal was going to be one of them, he's off the table. If there's no rematch with Lashley, well then who's next? Right? Who's next? I don't see them going with Aleister Black yet, although that would be interesting, babyface against babyface at SummerSlam. Seems a little too soon. I don't see that happening just yet. You know, who else is? I mean, we've seen Drew in the ring with Garza and Andrade. Then there's Randy Orton. Where does Randy Orton go when he's done feuding with Edge? Well, maybe he beats Edge, and then he's next in line to be number one contender for the WWE title. In order for that to really make sense and work, he's got to win. Then he can go say, look, I'm going to win the championship. Drew, I got you beat because, hell, I'm the greatest ever. I won the greatest wrestling match of all time. And then hopefully Drew beats him. So there's a lot more reasons why it makes sense that Orton would win this match than Edge. And by the way, McIntyre did a conference call, did a media call this week, and on the media call, who did he say he would like to wrestle at SummerSlam? Why, it was Randy Orton. So, there you go. I'm picking Randy Orton to win the not-so-greatest wrestling match ever, but I do think these two will go out there if they can just, you know, it's a straight wrestling match. I think one of the things that hurt them, besides the length, but more so than the length, you can have, and Brian, by the way, and AJ proved on Friday night, you could have a long 35-40 minute match and not bore people. and keep people on the edge of their seat. What really hurt Edge and Orton, I think, more than anything was the last man standing stipulation. And a lot of the stalling and the grunting and the slowness and the pace of the match, that's what killed it. This time, there is no last man standing. There is no, back up, we got to count to 10. There's none of that. Straight wrestling match. These guys have been doing this a long time. They're smart. They know what they're doing. They're veterans. They may go in there and have the match of the night. It could happen. But it may not even be the match of the week. Now, I mentioned the segment with Sheamus and Jeff Hardy from SmackDown. The only other thing from this show on Friday that, really the only great thing, because SmackDown was not a good show, but save for one thing. And that was the finals of the Intercontinental Championship Tournament between Daniel Bryan and AJ Styles, 2 days before a pay-per-view, with a match that they are promoting as the greatest wrestling match ever, or perhaps the greatest wrestling match ever. They had a classic on Fox on Friday night that is going to be very difficult for Edge and Randy Orton to top. Not impossible, but very difficult. That's why I say Edge and Orton may not even have match of the week honors, let alone the greatest match of all time. AJ was my pick to win the tournament when they first announced his trade to SmackDown. I didn't fall for the whole Brie Bella leak, quote-unquote leak, a week ago when she accidentally tweeted that photo of the Intercontinental title. It looked like it was on the mantle somewhere in their home, and it had the Daniel Bryan Yes side plates on it. Then she quickly deleted it, and that caused a little bit of a stir. I didn't say anything on Twitter about it because in case it was a spoiler, I didn't want to, you know, potentially spoil it for anybody. But when I saw that and everyone was like, oh man, she just spoiled the results, I'm like, don't be so sure about that. I'm sure they have a whole bunch of nameplates and side plates made for those belts for, you know, a lot of the key people on the brand. But these two had the kind of match, and I went online, as soon as the match was over, I went online, I said that these two had the kind of match that once defined the Intercontinental Championship. It used to be looked at, and maybe it still is, as the workhorse title in the company. That was the reputation that championship had for many years at a time when you had these giants and these monsters wrestling for the world championship. Hulk Hogan, right, defending against Paul Orndorff, Big John Studd, King Kong Bundy, Andre the Giant, Big Boss Man. All of these large men competing for the WWF title in what at the time was really a big man's territory. But then you had the Intercontinental, and you had people like Tito Santana, and you had Randy Savage, and you had Ricky Steamboat, and you had Mr. Perfect, and then Bret Hart, and Shawn Michaels, and you see a common theme here, right? You see a common thread. Some of the best wrestlers, workers in the entire company held that championship. There's a reason that in some markets back then, maybe it was the B crew, Hogan led the A crew, but you would have live events headlined by Intercontinental Championship matches. And you knew that those two guys would go out there and get 15, 20, 25 minutes, and they'd probably tear the house down, depending on who was in the ring. But that was the reputation for many, many years that that title had, you know, right on through the 90s, even, or at least until they got to the late 90s, and then it was, I won't even say that, because when you got to the late 90s, early 2000s, then you got into the Jerichos and the Benoits and the Eddie Guerreros, and I think even still, through that period, it was looked at as the workhorse title. But this is a championship that over the years has been diminished. Then they'll kind of build it back up and they'll revive it a little bit when it's convenient. When it is convenient for them to do so, let's put some shine on the Intercontinental. It's almost like they forgot. Don't forget that many years ago, they went, I think it was 7 straight WrestleMania shows. I think it was 7. 7 years. You could break a mirror and have 7 years of bad luck. Like Baron Corbin did in the gym back at the Money in the Bank match. 7 years, I think it was, straight of no Intercontinental title defenses at WrestleMania. That is how much they valued the Intercontinental Championship there for a while. So it goes through these peaks and valleys. I mean, they literally got rid of the title in 2002. They just merged it with the World Heavyweight title when Triple H beat Kane at No Mercy. That was during the Reign of Terror. Then 6 months or 8 months later, they brought it back. In recent years, give credit to The Miz. We've seen The Miz work hard to bring some prestige back to the title. Seth Rollins, I thought, had a fun run for a few months with the championship back in 2018, I think it was, when Monday Night Raw really did not have a champion because Brock Lesnar was gone so much. So the Intercontinental was positioned as the top title on the brand. Dolph Ziggler was in there too. He had a couple of runs during that period in recent years. And so you know, we've seen these peaks and valleys with the belt. These two guys here, AJ and Brian, they had a classic. 38 minutes, bell to bell, through four commercial breaks. It was as long as the Edge and Randy Orton match at WrestleMania, and I know some people are going to go, oh, you're a hypocrite. This was as long as the Edge and Orton match, and here you are singing its praises. The difference is I was never bored. I was never bored during this match, and yeah, we didn't have the dumb last man standing stipulation either. It was constant movement, constant action, very evenly matched. Styles would be in control, then Bryan, then back to AJ, and back and forth, all the near falls. You know, a match where you can have near falls is always going to have a leg up on a match like a last man standing because you don't have the benefit of the dramatic pinfalls. So that right there gave these two a leg up on Edge and Orton. That's the difference between the two. Styles went for the phenomenal forearm. Bryan caught him in an armbar. AJ reversed it into a calf crusher. There was a hard back suplex off the top rope by Bryan to AJ. Later on, Bryan locked on the yes lock. Styles made it to the ropes. My favorite spot of the whole match was Bryan. He was setting up in the corner for the running knee. He's doing the whole yes thing with his hands. And he comes running out of the corner. And as he runs and kind of leaps up at AJ, AJ catches him, like almost in position for a power bomb. But then he drops him down and turns it into a Styles clash. That was pretty cool. Couldn't capitalize on it. But he did eventually set up for the phenomenal forearm. He nailed it. And that is what won him his very first Intercontinental title. I'm sure somewhere Sheamus is green with envy that AJ has the one championship that he still does not have on his resume. Not counting the big blue belt. Sheamus has never been the Intercontinental champion. Now AJ Styles, he can say that he is. This was easily the best WWE television match of the year so far. And it'll be in the conversation, I think, for Match of the Year honors once this horrendous year is finally over. These two men did that title proud. You know, I know there were some people who were upset because I saw it all up and down my timeline. People who were upset that they didn't close out the show. They didn't headline SmackDown on Friday night. That didn't bother me so much. I'll tell you why. Didn't bother me because, first of all, I understand why they did that. Neither man is on the Backlash card tonight. Daniel Bryan is not wrestling tonight. AJ Styles is not defending, at least as I'm recording this, AJ Styles is not defending the championship tonight. So if they're not on the card for what was a SmackDown show, it was meant to be a go-home show to a pay-per-view, I kind of get it. Like, these two aren't even on the card tonight. They wanted Braun Strowman in the main event, which he was. He tagged with Heavy Machinery. They beat Dolph Ziggler, Miz, and Morrison. Whoop-de-friggin-do. Otis won with the, I think it was the Caterpillar on Ziggler. But the other benefit to not having these two close out the show, given that it ran through four commercial, I couldn't believe it ran four commercial breaks, is that you never knew when the match was going to end. Right? You know what time the show is going to end, but you know there's a main event yet to come. But when it's kind of positioned in the middle of the show like that, now it's run through the third and the fourth commercial break, it's like, shit, like how long are they going to go? You know, are they going to go until 9:45 and leave 10 minutes for the main event? It's kind of open-ended a little bit as far as, hey, when's the match going to end? If they close the show with it, then you know that this, you're just looking at the clock like, uh-oh, it's 9:55. It's 9:56. Any second now, this match is going to come to an end. Like, nobody is denying that this is not a main event on any show anywhere in the world. But I'm okay with it not closing. I didn't look at it as being that big of a deal. Really, you want to know what I think? This should have been the match to headline Backlash tonight. You really want to position that Intercontinental title as something special? They put together this great video package for the championship on Friday showing all of the former champions. They did a really good job. Very sports-like. The way that they put that video together and were really hyping the finals of this tournament. You could have done that and saved that for Backlash. You know, maybe they wanted to pop a number on Fox. The numbers were up on SmackDown a little bit this week. Maybe that's why they did it. But this is a match that was worthy of being on the Backlash card, and you could have headlined with this match. You headline your pay-per-view with two of your best talents in the finals of this tournament that you've been building for weeks and weeks. So, the fact they're not even on the Backlash card is head-scratching to me. But I thought it was very smart to have Drew Gulak pin AJ Styles on TV last week. Because now that AJ is the champion, it sets up Gulak perfectly to be his first challenger. He can now claim that he has a win over the champion. And that he should be first in line for a crack at that title. And then there's Matt Riddle. Matt Riddle, we now know, will make his SmackDown debut, or I guess debut, as he would say, this Friday night. Too soon to jump into Styles and Riddle. I mean, we already see Karrion Kross has been in NXT for, 2 seconds, and apparently he's going to be challenging soon for the NXT Championship. You can't do that with everybody. Too soon to jump into AJ and Riddle. Let Riddle rack up a few wins. Let him establish an identity for himself on the show. Not everybody knows who he is. And a few months from now, if AJ is still the champion, which, hopefully he will be, let him have some good matches, some good TV matches and defenses against some people. You then build to Matt Riddle, maybe, challenging AJ Styles for the Intercontinental title. I mean, that's a match that I'd love to see. I don't know if SummerSlam might be too soon for that. Probably is. Maybe sometime in the fall. But that would be the direction that I would work towards. And I don't believe the two of them have ever had a match before. SmackDown on Friday was a fail. SmackDown on Friday night was a fail. It was a fail that just so happened to be highlighted by one of the best WWE matches that I have seen in a very long time. It was a fail because it was a go-home show to a pay-per-view that I don't have any more interest in seeing than I did coming into it. For that reason, the show did not succeed. It did not succeed in what it was supposed to do, which was to get me more interested in wanting to see Backlash. Shout out to the redneck rookie, Edward Valenzuela, John Raging Mad Riffle, Rockhard Russell Segee, James Lights Out Lee, Flawless Francisco Figueredo, and Sebastian Drea, and also the tag team of Bulldog and Nosedive. They do a podcast together called Bulldog's Got the Book. They revisit pro wrestling storylines from yesteryear and do some fantasy booking. They fantasy book how things could have gone differently. Their first three episodes are now available wherever you listen to podcasts, including What If Hulk Hogan Turned Heel in 1992? Talking about the invasion in 2001. God, don't remind me of that. And also Bret Hart's WCW run. Also, don't remind me. I'm sure these two will do a much better job than WWE and WCW did with both of those storylines, so check them out. And finally here, I got to shout out Dean. Dean the Mighty Mo Mowbray. You might have remembered that name. I talked about Dean last month. I plugged his Scenescape shop on Etsy, which you can find at etsy.com/shop/scenescape shop. He was, as he said in his own words, he was made redundant recently at work. And so he has taken a go at starting his own business as a painter. And, so he's not a professional or anything, but he started this business. He started painting. He's getting better at it all the time. It's one of the things I love about his work, right? I mean, if you've seen some of the paintings from the last time I talked about it, again, he's not a pro, but I think his work is really very good. And when I talked about his store last month, apparently he saw this big spike in sales, which was really cool to hear. And he wanted to thank all of you who did purchase, something from the store for all of your support. He's got a whole new batch of paintings up in his store, including Stone Cold's return at Backlash in 2000, Hulk Hogan slamming Andre the Giant, the Macho Man's cream of the crop promo, and a ton of different movie and television paintings as well. Nightmare on Elm Street, Bill and Ted, Wally, Wonder Woman, Thundercats, a whole bunch of them. He just started a YouTube channel at Scenescape Shop. He plans to release a new video every Tuesday, painting something that he'll then put on sale. Go ahead and follow him on Facebook and Instagram, at Scenescape Shop. Tell him I sent you. And for all orders, either signed, frame prints, you know, whatever you prefer, give a store a visit. I think you'll like it. You might find something on there you like. Go to Scenescape Shop on Etsy. It's etsy.com/shop/Scenescape Shop. In late 1995, Vince McMahon shocked a lot of people around him in the company behind the scenes when he brought Cowboy Bill Watts into the company. He brought him in at the recommendation of Jim Ross. Jim Ross is the biggest Cowboy fan in the world. He worked for Bill Watts. He kind of was under the learning tree with Bill Watts. And he recommended that Vince bring him in because I guess Vince McMahon was looking to step back a little bit and focus more on the behind-the-scenes business end of the company and less so on the creative end. And he gave Watts what he told Watts at the time would be full autonomy over the creative direction of the product. And I guess that, you know, what Watts thought would also be the authority to make certain other decisions behind the scenes without having to worry about being overruled. He wasn't interested in coming in and being, you know, working for someone else and being told what to do, yes and no. He was told that we're going to bring you in and I'm going to take a step back and you're going to have the freedom to kind of, you know, put a system in place that you think works and creatively go in the direction that you feel you want to go in. It took less than 3 weeks before he was overruled on something and he quit the company. And many years later, in a shoot interview, Watts said that Vince McMahon has a serious problem with delegating authority. And so it should come as no surprise that 1 year later, 1 year after WWE made a huge splash by announcing the appointment of Paul Heyman as the new executive director of Monday Night Raw and Eric Bischoff as the new executive director for SmackDown, 12 months later, and neither man occupies the position for which they were hired. This is a segment of the sound off here that you could have predicted the minute those hires were announced. If I were to say to you, a year from now, I'm going to be doing a whole segment on the show talking about the firing of Eric Bischoff and Paul Heyman, I don't think a single one of you would have been shocked. It was only a matter of when. It was not a matter of if. Although I had hopes at the time that it would turn out differently. I tried. I tried to be optimistic. Foolishly, naively, maybe, but I tried to be optimistic that maybe, just maybe, Vince McMahon was trying to shake things up for real and create real change on his television shows. And that he would have the patience to stick with it and hopefully both shows over time would improve. You know, after all, he was restarting the XFL, and maybe his football fetish would take his attention away from the creative end of things and allow other people to have more of a say and have more of a hand in the day-to-day, week-to-week creative decisions. But then COVID killed the XFL, and the football league went away, and so it was all wrestling again. And it's still amazing. It's 74 years old. I think he'll be 75 in August. As involved as he is and as hands-on as Vince McMahon still is, right on down to, you know, the urine segment on SmackDown or just these dumb television segments, you know, in a way, it's kind of admirable that he still has the stamina and the energy to be this involved and this hands-on and work as many hours as he works. I mean, I admire the man's work ethic, don't get me wrong. I mean, he's got a work ethic that would put a lot of people to shame. But when you're 75 years old, you really need to be involved in the day-to-day creative decisions. I mean, this is such a big business now. I just think back to the Watts story from 1995 when the company was not doing well financially. And the company was a hell of a lot smaller and less profitable than it is today. And even then, he wanted to take a step back, apparently. He wanted to take a step back and focus on the core business and not so much all the creative stuff and dealing with all the egos and all the bullshit that goes into it. And here we are now, 25 years later, and he is as involved in the most minute of creative decisions as he has ever been. In the ears of the announcers, everything that we hear about Vince McMahon. Does he really need to still be that involved at his age, as big as this business has grown? Apparently the answer is yes. On Thursday, WWE issued a statement that read as follows. A brief statement. It says, in an effort to streamline our creative writing process for television, we have consolidated both teams from Raw and SmackDown into one group led by Bruce Pritchard. Paul Heyman will concentrate on his role as an in-ring performer. 1 year ago, where were we? Where were we in June of 2019? The shows were abysmal. The television shows were abysmal. Some people would say they still are. But a year ago, they were horrendous. And the week that they announced the new positions for Bischoff and for Heyman, Monday Night Raw had 3,500 people in the audience that week, or the week before. SmackDown had dwindled to 2,500. This is the kind of live business they were doing for the, and these are not just house shows. These were television tapings. Monday Night Raw, 3 hours of Monday Night Raw, or actually 4 hours, I guess, if they tape matches for main event or whatever before Raw. 2,500 people in the building for SmackDown. This is back during that period where they had to tarp off more than half the building and film it a certain way to make it look more full than it really was. This was the state of WWE at that time. Television ratings were at record lows. This is the part where 2020 would tell 2019, hold my beer. But the shows were as bad as they had ever been. And I was encouraged when I heard about the changes because it meant that they at least recognized that there was a problem and hopefully they were going to start making some moves to address those problems. But remember the skepticism that I had. Because both men were still reporting directly to Vince McMahon. And it was said at the time that Vince McMahon would still have final say over what we saw on these shows. These were not positions of full autonomy at all. It was all reporting to Vince. Vince was going to make the final decision and put his stamp of approval on it. That was not going to change. And that was reason enough to be skeptical about all of this. Eric Bischoff, he was the first one to fall. 4 months. I mean, I'm talking about a year later. This was 4 months. 4 months after he was hired for the job. He even moved his family from Wyoming all the way to Connecticut. He since claimed, well, you know, the job wasn't really a good fit because Vince McMahon had certain expectations that I couldn't meet. It just didn't work out. And so the axe fell, and in stepped Bruce Pritchard to take his place as the new executive director of SmackDown. This was only a matter of months after he was rehired by the company to join the creative team. He had been out. He had been gone from WWE for, I think, about a decade. Actually, it might have been more. So I think it was 08 when he got fired the second time. And early 2019, he was officially back in the fold. He was back in the family. I mean, Bruce Pritchard has engineered quite the comeback story. He has been with WWE off and on, mostly on, but he's been with WWE off and on since 1987. He's been fired twice. The first time in 1991, the second time in 2008. He has been one of Vince McMahon's closest confidants. A few years ago, he started a podcast with Conrad Thompson that even got picked up by WWE. It got picked up by the WWE Network, briefly. Or at least another version of it was. You can trace Pritchard's comeback right back to the success of that podcast. Without that podcast, I don't believe that he is in the position that he's in right now. I hope Conrad got himself a finder's fee. But he gets rehired by WWE. Lands himself an executive director position when one guy gets fired. And when the other guy gets fired, he takes over the whole damn thing. At least in title. Because we all know nobody ever really takes anything over in this company. Not when Vince McMahon is still involved. And we all know that the same thing that happened to Bischoff and the same thing that happened to Paul Heyman is going to eventually happen to Bruce Pritchard. Again, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. He's smart enough where I think it's going to be a while. I think he's safe. He's been around this place. He's danced this dance for a lot of years. I think he's savvy enough and smart enough where he'll stick it out longer than the other two did. He'll certainly last longer than Bischoff did. I think it's safe to say he'll last longer than 4 months. He is smart to the way that Vince McMahon does things. He has worked for Vince McMahon a lot longer than either Eric Bischoff or Paul Heyman, even the two of them combined. You know, people have called him a yes man. I'm sure he would dispute that, because of course he would. But he knows what Vince McMahon likes, and he knows what Vince McMahon does not like. And he writes for an audience of one. Or he oversees the writing for an audience of one. But I love, by the way, that statement that WWE put out. I love how that statement said that Paul Heyman will concentrate on his role as an in-ring performer. like he's training at the performance center, trying to drop weight for his in-ring debut. I can picture him now, you know, coming out for his entrance, bouncing up and down the way that Brock Lesnar bounces up and down, wearing the Jimmy John shorts. What will he be? What will Paul Heyman be? Will he be a high flyer? Will he dive? Since everybody in the company is mandated to do at least one dive per match, I don't think he's going to be able to get out of it. What an odd thing to say. He is an on-screen performer. He is not an in-ring performer. Those are two very different things. That'd be like saying Michael Cole is, you know, he took a vacation and Michael Cole is back as an in-ring performer. We've seen Michael Cole as an in-ring performer. I don't need to see Michael Cole again as an in-ring performer. One of the worst WrestleMania matches of all time. The Observer said that Heyman was working with two contracts, one as a performer, the other being an employee management deal that has since been terminated. Mike Johnson of PW Insider said it was purely a Vince McMahon call. A source noted to him that Vince McMahon has been very upset and openly frustrated of late with Monday Night Raw. Fancy that. I just learned that Vince McMahon and I actually have something in common. We've both been very upset and openly frustrated with Monday Night Raw. Now if I find out that he likes Hall & Oates, it'll blow my mind. One of the positive things about what Paul Heyman had done with Monday Night Raw is focus on new faces. He focused on new faces and new talents. Drew McIntyre is in a prime position right now as the champion. We saw renewed focus on certain people like Angel Garza, who I think the sky's the limit for him. I know he's not physically a very big guy, but Angel Garza should go far in this company. He's got a ton of charisma. He's a very good wrestler. Angel Garza, he should be one of the premier stars on that brand in the next few years. So I hope we continue to see an Angel Garza push. But Angel Garza and Andrade and the Street Profits and Apollo Crews, right? We've seen this renewed focus and push for some of these guys. And the fact that Heyman was taking the time to try to build them up as stars. Now, I understand that. I understand what he was trying to do, and I understand that they do need to make new stars because the old stars are aging out. They're not going to be able to rely on them forever. This is what happens, by the way. When you rely too heavily on nostalgia, and you rely too heavily on the stars of the past, as they've done over the years, eventually that's going to come back to bite you on the ass if you haven't done a good job of building up new stars to kind of slip right in and take their spot. They have not done a very good job of that in recent years. We saw the Shield guys. The Shield guys were probably the biggest new stars that the company has made or put their promotional muscle behind in the last 5 years. Daniel Bryan took off finally after he had been in the company for a few years. You can pick names here and there, but has the company really done this tremendous job of creating this wealth of new stars? No. They really haven't. When you look at all the talent they have under contract right now and the number of like really, you know, people that you can really call new stars who have gotten over on television, no, I don't think they've done a great job. So Heyman was trying with some of these people. Try to put some new faces in place. But I'm not going to sit here and sing the praises of Paul Heyman on Monday Night Raw. I'm not going to sit here and rant about, oh, what an awful thing. I can't believe they did Paul Heyman dirty. He's been removed. And what a terrible thing it is. For this reason, whoever you want to blame for this, the reality is this. Paul Heyman, yes, he's been the executive director of Monday Night Raw now for a year. And yes, he does not have autonomous power to do anything that he wants. He is still answering to the old man. All that being said, the reality is this. Monday Night Raw is still an unexciting, uninteresting television show. Paul Heyman may have been taking his time and he may have been trying. Maybe he would have gotten there eventually. But Monday Night Raw is still a bad show. It was a bad show a year ago, and it is a bad show today. Maybe a little less bad, but it's still bad. There will be weeks here and there where they pop a good one out, but so long as the show remains 3 hours, which is a decision that was beyond Paul Heyman's control, it's a decision that's going to be beyond Bruce Pritchard's control. So long as the show is 3 hours every single week, this will never change. 3 hours of Monday Night Raw every week is very different than a 3-hour pay-per-view once a month. I've seen some people over the years when I've criticized the 3-hour format, well, aren't pay-per-views 3 hours? Don't you ever watch a 3 or 4 hour pay-per-view show that you go, man, that was a great show? Good point. Yes, I do. I do. Two very different things. Two very different things. A Monday Night Raw, it's not just action. It's not just matches. You got commercial break. It feels like they've got more commercial breaks on the show now than they did maybe even a year ago. And you can have, look, you got to pay the bills, you know? Got to have commercial breaks. I understand that. No problem. But I think they can sometimes do a better job of positioning them on the show. When you have a match, you know, we had 4 commercial breaks during Daniel Bryan and AJ Styles on Friday on Fox. Now, when the match is that long, you're going to have a lot of commercial breaks. But sometimes I feel like, you know, the match begins, the bell rings, oh, we got to go to break. Then they come back and they do 3 moves, oh, we got to go to break. That doesn't help. That doesn't help. But with the pay-per-views, you know, with the right matches and the right mix of stars, you can have an excellent 3-hour pay-per-view. Everything that you see on the television shows is building to that one big pay-per-view every single month, and that is the key. Once a month, you have this big 3-hour show or 3.5-hour show. It's a lot easier to put on an enjoyable, you know, 3 or 4-hour show once a month that breezes by without commercials than it is a 3-hour television show, 52 weeks a year. The erosion of Raw's television audience ever since 2012 when they went to 3 hours is proof of what I am talking about. It has been a steady decline. The pandemic just worsened a problem that already existed. I don't want to hear, it's all the pandemic's fault. No, it's not. This was a problem before anybody even knew what COVID was. You make it sound like this has been a problem since February or since March. You must be new here. They can't do it. Paul Heyman couldn't do it, and Bruce Pritchard won't be able to do it either. SmackDown doesn't take it on the chin the way the Raw does, because it is an easier show to watch at 2 hours instead of 3. But there have been plenty of dreadful SmackDown shows since coming to Fox. Let's not kid ourselves into thinking that SmackDown has been, you know, much better under the thumb of Bruce Pritchard than Raw was under the thumb of Paul Heyman. But I generally find more to like on Fridays than I do on Mondays, despite Baron Corbin being on the roster. I was enjoying the Mandy and Otis storyline. It's, you know, it's kind of, I don't want to say it's past its expiration point, but we got the peak, right? The peak was Otis gets the girl. So now they're kind of like treading water a little bit. I still enjoy the interplay between them, but you know, that storyline was paid off at WrestleMania, and it was a great story. It was a simple story. I enjoyed it. I really did. SmackDown now has 2 of the best, you know, talents in the entire company in Daniel Bryan and AJ Styles. Now Matt Riddle is coming to SmackDown, so they're bringing some new talent from NXT. I've grown to really like the job that Bayley has done as a heel champion on the SmackDown brand. I wasn't sold on her at first, but now I am. Yeah, the tag team division is a mess. They got hurt by Jimmy Uso's injury. He's going to be gone for a while. and the Forgotten Sons are better left forgotten. But the point is, these shows are still the creative vision of one man. When you keep the same showrunner and refuse to change, and I've used The Walking Dead in the past as an example of this. The Walking Dead, a lot of people used to watch The Walking Dead. The Walking Dead used to get upwards of 20 million viewers every single week in the early seasons of the show. And now the show is in season 10 or 11 now. I still watch it. I feel like I'm one of the few. There's a hell of a lot less than 20 million people watching The Walking Dead now. But they've gone through a whole bunch of different showrunners. And like the last one they brought in, there was a noticeable improvement in the quality and the direction of the show because it was a different vision. Somebody was brought in with a fresher, different vision than the person before them. And so far, I think it's paid off. I think it's worked. I think the show has improved to the point where I think if people were to give it another shot, if they had previously watched, they probably would enjoy it. But that's just one example. When you have the same showrunner year after year after year, and they refuse to change the way that they do things, and they have a very narrow-minded vision of what they think is entertaining and what the audience wants to see, there is not much that you can do. I don't care who they bring in. You can talk about how Paul Heyman is going to change Raw and push new faces, but they weren't getting over fast enough. Well, you know what? How do you even measure that? That's my other question. How do you even measure anymore who's getting over and who's what's working and what's not when you have no audiences? How do you know how over Drew McIntyre is or how over Andrade is or Angel Garza or Apollo Crews or Bobby Lashley when you don't have live crowds to react to them in real time and tell you what works and what doesn't? Not that they always listen to us, but isn't that what we've always been told? It's a business based on audience reaction and crowd reaction and playing off the crowd. Well, now there are no crowds. It has fundamentally changed the way that they do business and the way that they book these shows. And I said, when this all started, I said, this is going to be the biggest problem of all. Because now Vince McMahon has no barometer for what works and what doesn't. It's just, this is what I want and this is what I think works. And there's nobody there in the building that's going to say or react in a way that tells him otherwise. They got people in the audience from the PC. They may as well put an applause sign up and go, okay, clap like seals. Clap like seals. They'll react the way that they think Vince McMahon wants them to react. There is no longer that instant feedback from the audience. And that has, I think, in a lot of ways made things worse. The only thing that you're left with as far as how do you measure what works and what doesn't is television ratings. Big, fat TV contracts. One with NBC Universal, one with Fox. I will never miss an opportunity to make fun of all the people who say that ratings don't matter anymore. Every chance I get to make fun of these people, I take full advantage of it. So I am more than happy to mention that again here. And what a fool these people are. Nobody is saying that the ratings have the same impact maybe that they had during the Monday Night War, plus you had a competition back then. You know, Raw doesn't have another competing wrestling show on Monday nights. And yes, technology is very different now. There are different ways to watch the show. So the world has changed in 20 years. Nobody is denying that. But this insistence by some people that ratings don't matter, you're just a fool. You're just a fool. And now it's the only way that they can measure what, I mean, outside of merch, I guess, they can measure who's selling the most merchandise. Although they're not selling any merch at live events because there are no live events. It's all online. But really, the only way right now until crowds come back to measure things is by looking at the television ratings and looking at the quarter hours every single week and the demos and all of that stuff. Monday Night Raw has logged some of the worst ratings in the history of the show during this pandemic. SmackDown has also seen the worst ratings of the Fox era in the last few weeks. At least this week, they were back up over 2 million viewers. Overnight viewers. Raw has been languishing under 2 million viewers now for weeks. 1.7 million viewers each of the last 4 weeks. And what's funny about this idea that Paul Heyman was fired because the Raw ratings were so bad is that when you compare the Raw numbers to the SmackDown numbers during the COVID era, the Performance Center era, it's even Steven. far as the percentage of the audience that each show has lost, yes, SmackDown numbers are a little bit higher, but you would expect them to be because it's on network television. But SmackDown, since March, is down 25%. Monday Night Raw, since March, is down 25%. So I think there's a lot more going on here than just television ratings being down. Because if it was only about TV ratings, we'd be getting the inevitable podcast with Bruce Pritchard talking about why he got fired for a third time. Not only did he keep his job, he now has more responsibilities than ever before. This now puts Brother Love in charge of 5 hours of content every week on television. So something else is going on here. And we'll have to wait and see if more reports come out. Maybe there was... Look, it wouldn't be the first time that Vince McMahon and Paul Heyman had some kind of big blow-up backstage. The famous story of the big blow-up on the corporate jet when Heyman left or got fired or quit, whatever happened back in 06 after the December to Dismember pay-per-view. What a disaster that was. And then we didn't see Heyman again for another 6 years until Brock Lesnar came back. Let's see what other stories leak out in the next few weeks. But to me, this just reeks of something more than just television ratings. Vince McMahon talked about the declining numbers on their earnings call back in April. Remember that? That was the call where he mentioned, well, we don't have Brock Lesnar anymore. as like one of the main reasons that Raw has suffered. I love that. I get a nice laugh, a nice chuckle out of that every time I think back to that. Of course, they don't have Brock Lesnar anymore. That explains it. They don't have Brock Lesnar most of the fucking year. You can't explain the numbers away by saying, oh, we don't have Brock Lesnar anymore. But he also said, we have a new champion, we have a lot of new performers. And he admitted in his own words, this was Vince McMahon in his own words, it takes a while to get these people over. This was only, what was this, 2 months ago. I don't even think this was a full 8 weeks ago. What happened in those 8 weeks that his whole perspective changed? Now look, there could have been certain talents or other people behind the scenes who also did not like the job that Paul Heyman was doing. There's a rumor that the reason AJ Styles was moved, he was traded over to SmackDown, is because he did not get along with Paul Heyman. He didn't like him. And if Heyman's idea was to push new faces and younger talent and build around newer, younger talent, then you could understand why 43-year-old AJ Styles might not be too fond of his vision. I'm just saying, I'm not saying that's the reason why, but if there was some kind of issue there, you can understand maybe that had something to do with it. FTR, the former Revival, when they were on the podcast last week with Jim Cornette, they were asked about, you know, what was it like to deal with Paul Heyman and Bruce Pritchard? Who is the better person to deal with? And I think it was Scott Dawson who said, at least Bruce Pritchard, in their words, doesn't believe the bullshit that comes out of his mouth. Whereas Paul Heyman would cut it up and he would serve it to them on a platter in their dealings with him. But they also admitted, they said, look, we don't envy the positions that either guy is in. They said that all these guys are doing, they are saying and doing whatever they have to do to survive, to keep their jobs, and to make their money. And that really is the biggest issue here. Is there anyone in a position of power or authority in this company or in a creative capacity? Is there anyone at all who has the balls to have a frank conversation with Vince McMahon about his ideas and his television product? I talked about the interview Road Dogg did with Corey Graves. He clearly doesn't. Is there anyone else? If Pritchard is just going to write what he thinks Vince McMahon wants to see, and if Vince McMahon was unhappy with Paul Heyman developing new talent and new stars, then what does that mean for Drew McIntyre as WWE champion? What does that mean for Bobby Lashley? What does that mean for all these other talents and Murphy and Austin Theory and Shayna Baszler? That's the real question here. How different is Monday Night Raw going to look coming out of Backlash? And over the next, let's say, 6 weeks, how different is it going to look than it looks right now? It's possible that Paul Heyman already had plans in place that he was building to certain SummerSlam matches, and now that could all go out the window. There could be radical change coming to Monday Night Raw. And look, I'm all for radical change if it's the right change. If it's going to make the show better, if it's going to make the show more fun, if it's going to be more of pissing in a cup and drug testing and bullshit like that, then no thank you. I'm just not convinced watching SmackDown every single week that Bruce Pritchard is the answer. But if not Bruce, then who? Who? I sound like New Day now. Who? If not him, then who? That's a trick question, by the way. There is no real answer to that. Actually, there is. The answer is no one. The answer is no one. Unless Vince McMahon cedes that power to somebody else, that person does not exist. Because as long, and if I'm Paul Levesque, I'm staying as far the fuck away from Raw and SmackDown as I possibly can. I see what's going on here. This guy gets fired. That guy gets fired. He's having a tough enough time. He can't even beat AEW on Wednesday nights. If I'm Paul Levesque, I'm more than happy to take a back seat here. I'm in no rush to come to Raw or SmackDown to take over on the creative end. As long as Vince McMahon has his hands on the creative process, anybody in that position, like Pritchard, is going to be in self-preservation mode. Got to keep my job. Got to keep my position. That's all that matters. Don't piss off Vince. It's his company. It's his product. Let's not rock the boat. Because they see someone like Heyman who at least tried to do something with some new faces, and the boss just didn't have the patience to see if it would have paid off or not. So far, it has not. So far, it has not paid off. And so if you don't want to lose your job, you're going to be a lot less likely to go out on a limb and try something new. Now, what this means for Paul Heyman's future on TV is another question, because right now he has one client, and that client is Brock Lesnar, who we have not seen on television since he lost to Drew McIntyre at WrestleMania. We may not be seeing much of Paul Heyman at all, if that's the case, because all these years of wondering, will there be another Heyman guy? Are we going to get a Heyman girl? At one point, I thought it might be Ronda Rousey, because the two of them were close. Are we going to get a Heyman guy or a Heyman girl? We had Cesaro after WrestleMania 30, and we had Curtis Axel. Neither one worked out very well. I mean, Curtis Axel did win the Intercontinental title. But after that, what else did he do? What else did Curtis Axel do? The answer is nothing. He did nothing. The Cesaro-Heyman pairing was such a waste. They never even gave it a real chance. You could have paid that thing off down the road with a Cesaro-Brock Lesnar match, and they couldn't even do that. They couldn't even get that right. Now we have MVP on Raw. He's recruiting Lashley. He was hanging out with Shane Thorne and Brendan Vink from NXT a few weeks ago, which looks to be dead now. We haven't seen them on TV in a few weeks. If they want a manager type, they've already got one. They've got MVP. MVP is fine in that role. I don't need to see MVP in the ring. He can do fine in that role as an agent. Just like Paul Heyman, right? He was an agent. They could always find that one guy if they want to for Heyman to take under his wing. But that idea, this idea now that Paul Heyman, we might get a Heyman, a new dangerous alliance or something like that. I don't see it. If it was going to happen, it would have happened by now. I don't even know that Heyman is interested in that. I don't see that happening. Paul Heyman lasted a lot longer than Eric Bischoff did. Because Paul Heyman, at least, he had product knowledge, he knew the faces, he knew the names, he was up on all the storylines, and he had ideas of his own. For all of his ideas, however long-term they may have been, if you think that Monday Night Raw is a terrible show, he bears some of the responsibility for that. But at the end of the day, it's still a one-man show, and when they fired Eric Bischoff, I said it then and I'll say it again. Now they've gone and fired Paul Heyman. You can't fire your way out of this problem. When all these people are fired or relieved from their positions, after a while, you kind of ask yourself, are they the problem? Or is there some other problem here? You can't just fire your way out of this and expect that your fortunes are just going to miraculously change. I'm sure some of the numbers will improve when people start coming back to the buildings and they can start getting back to normal. I don't know how long that's going to take. Then you'll see all the people will pipe up and say, oh, you see, it was all COVID because numbers are going to go back up. But the question is, how high are they going to go? Are you going to get back all of those fans who have abandoned Monday Night Raw? 1.7 is a new low point. Are you going to get all those people back, or are you losing some of these people forever? Like you did when WCW died and people were like, you know what? I don't need wrestling. When enough months go by and people find that, you know, life goes on without pro wrestling, they might be a lot less likely to come back. Change can only come from the top. I'll keep saying it every year until it finally happens. Real change starts at the top. It's top down, not bottom up. Vince McMahon's biggest fan is Vince McMahon. His second biggest fan is Bruce Pritchard. Bruce Pritchard has made a very lucrative living for himself doing exactly what he thinks that Vince McMahon wants him to do because Vince McMahon is his boss. And what Vince wants, Vince gets. Bruce Pritchard is not going to change anything. New Japan Pro Wrestling, which has not run a show since February 26th, returns to action starting tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow, starting at 6 a.m. Eastern Time, New Japan is back with a series of empty arena shows. The card for the June 15th show will not be announced until bell time, so we don't know anything about it. Then starting this Tuesday, June 16th, it is the start of the 32-man New Japan Cup tournament, which had been delayed from March. All 8 New Japan Cup events will play to empty buildings before they finally let fans attend for the finals at Osaka Joe Hall on June 11th, or July, I should say, July 11th, and their rescheduled Dominion show then takes place in the same venue the next day on July 12th. The Osaka shows, they're going to be run at one-third capacity, so around 4,000 fans in the building, which is a pretty sizable number. The way New Japan has dealt with this pandemic so far, I think, is actually pretty commendable. They just stopped. They did not want to take the risk, safety-wise, health-wise. They didn't want anybody to feel as if, oh, well, we gotta go to work, we gotta go perform because everybody else is. They just stopped. They just stopped doing shows. They did not feel the need to put their talent or their staff in harm's way. They locked everything down. No talent got laid off. Nobody was furloughed. Talent got paid even with no events taking place, no tickets being sold. They got paid their full salaries. The statement that New Japan put out at the time said, as for wrestler pay, we want every wrestler to be in the absolute best shape that they can be in when matches return, and wrestlers should be able to focus on their training without worrying about how they're going to make a living. And instead, they had executives at the parent company and at New Japan itself, management, they took pay cuts instead of the talent. The executives took pay cuts. I think they deserve praise for the way that they handled things. Not every company is going to have the financial means to do what they did. But you also have companies that do have the means who choose to do otherwise. So anyway, I think they deserve some credit for that. All shows will air live on New Japan World. And Tetsuya Naito, who, let's not forget, he holds both the IWGP and the IWGP Intercontinental Championships. He will defend both belts against the winner of the New Japan Cup. According to a report in The Observer, they are still taking very strict measures with regard to the virus and keeping talent safe, keeping fans safe. These are just some examples of what they are. I mean, they're not playing around here. Yeah, they may be restarting shows here because I guess the state of emergency in Japan was lifted at the end of May. They were not going to resume shows until that happened. Once that happened, they started to put plans in place, but they are not messing around here. They are not playing games. All wrestlers and staff working these shows are required to take their temperature when they wake up in the morning, take it again before they go to bed at night, log that information, I guess, in a journal of sorts, and then share that with the company. Any symptoms at all will land them in quarantine. Anybody with a fever above 99.5 will not be allowed into the venues. For the fans in Osaka, masks must be worn at all times. There will be temperature checks at the door. They will be required to submit their contact information, either a phone number or an email or whatever, on their ticket stub. They have to stay 6 feet apart if they're talking or communicating with each other. And this right here is why these shows, even though they're going to have people, are not going to necessarily mean loud crowds, this last part here. Fans are being asked to keep all loud cheering to a minimum. I guess as a way to lower the spread of droplets, which is kind of weird, because if they're going to have masks on, you would think, what's the difference if you know they're kind of loud? But, you know, again, it doesn't look like they're messing around. They don't want people to be cheering too loudly at these shows. And you're already going to be at, you know, one-third capacity. So they'll be back in buildings with people, but it doesn't sound like there's going to be, you know, very intense crowd reactions here, probably on any of these shows. There will be no meet and greets. Talents must pack their own food instead of the usual catering they would have backstage. And they have to bring food with their names printed on the packages. They should all bring lunchboxes, just like elementary school. I very much would like to see Minoru Suzuki arriving at the building with his Transformers lunchbox, his bologna sandwich inside. Not one person would fuck with him. When I did my prediction show at the start of the year, I do my annual prediction podcast, and I picked Sonata. Sonata was my pick to win the New Japan Cup, but then he would fall short in the match against Naito and not win the IWGP title. It might be tempting, though, you know, given the way things have gone. They had to cancel the anniversary show back in March. They started promoting that big match for the anniversary show. It was going to be Naito against Hiromu. And that match never took place. It's a match that we just never got to see. You could have Hiromu win the New Japan Cup, and then we get the match that we never got at the anniversary show. You know, you can have Okada win, and he can kind of rematch with Naito. I'm sticking with Sonata. I'm not going to change now. I'm picking Sonata as the guy to win the New Japan Cup. They will not have foreign talent for a while. Aside from anybody who may already live in Japan, those people they could use, you know, Will Ospreay, he's been all in on New Japan. He moved himself out to Japan. He's got a home, a house, or an apartment, whatever, in Japan. The problem is he's not in Japan right now. When this all started, he went back home to the UK. And so he's not able to get back into Japan right now. And it doesn't look like he's been able really to do much of anything outside of training and bulking up based on the photos that he has shared on social media. He's up 25 pounds from 9 months ago. Will Ospreay is now 227 pounds and he is ripped. This guy is shredded. Says that he has been focusing on heavy lifting during all of this downtime. Yeah, you think? He said, I can't say that I won't be doing flips anymore, but I think calling myself the aerial assassin has passed. This guy looks like he's getting ready to challenge for the IWGP title. No more of this junior heavyweight shit. He's ready to move on up. Maybe Will Ospreay as the G1 winner later this year. Hey, it could happen. It could happen. I hope to be able to catch some of the shows and try to be all caught up on everything that's going to be going on. I feel like I've been working from home and I feel like I'm busier than ever. I'm not sure how that happened. I'm not sure exactly how that works. But hey, I'm not complaining. I guess that's not such a bad thing, right? It could be a lot worse. Meanwhile, New Japan held a secret television taping yesterday in Los Angeles. They have a training dojo out in L.A. I don't know if it was at the training dojo or some other facility, but according to PW Insider, as many as 10 matches were taped. All American talent were used. It was on a closed set, observing social distancing. I always laugh, like, it's pro wrestling. There is no such thing as social distancing when it comes to pro wrestling. I mean, maybe social distancing with the fans or the people on the set. Wrestlers cannot social distance. But anyway, apparently they were observing social distancing rules, and they featured the debut of former MLW champion Tom Lawler. Tom Lawler is now with New Japan. And among the other names who worked the taping, Jeff Cobb, who we saw not too long ago on AEW Dynamite, Rocky Romero, and TJP, Among others, Carl Fredericks was another name I saw mentioned. No word yet on when or how this footage is going to be used. It's kind of strange, having a secret TV taping. I guess it's a secret no more. Speaking of MLW, they've signed a deal, MLW has, with the streaming service DAZN to be the first pro wrestling promotion to stream on the service, on the platform. Shows have already started airing on DAZN, including episodes of MLW Fusion. If you watch MLW Fusion on beIN Sports, fear not. It will continue to air on beIN Sports. If you watch the episodes on YouTube, maybe fear a little bit because it doesn't sound like they're going to be keeping them up on YouTube for much longer. I guess the ad revenue for them on YouTube is just not worth it. So for the time being, it's still on beIN Sports and YouTube, as well as DAZN. And apparently when live events resume, whenever that may be, they will have the ability to broadcast some of those live shows on DAZN. So they might be able to start having these live, you know, maybe like monthly pay-per-view style events. They are said to still be in talks with at least one U.S. cable outlet. No word on which one that is. PW Insider did say that earlier this year, as recently as January, they were having discussions with ESPN. This was right before ESPN, you know, the pandemic hit. ESPN picked up some WWE content. I think, didn't they air one of the WrestleManias on ESPN? It's like WrestleMania 3. And then I think they shifted all of the, you know, classic WWE content pretty much over to FS1. In fact, this Tuesday, they're airing the 1996 Survivor Series, which is kind of random. But I guess the Survivor Series in 96 had the very first match between Bret Hart and Stone Cold Steve Austin. Bret Hart was going to actually be the guest on WWE Backstage Tuesday night. I guess maybe he'll talk about that match. That was, of course, the night, maybe this is why they're airing it, that was the night that The Rock, Rocky Maivia, made his in-ring debut on WWE television in Madison Square Garden. So FS1 is really, it's really become the wrestling channel. They're airing WWE content, a ton of it, every single week, and getting a few hundred thousand viewers. They're probably getting more viewers for those shows than they are for WWE Backstage. talking about the current content. More people want to watch Survivor Series 1996 than listen to Christian and Renee Young talk about Jeff Hardy peeing in a cup on SmackDown. Go figure. So I don't know where those discussions were left off. If they have resumed discussions, maybe that's the cable provider that MLW is talking to. There were other rumors months ago that they had interest from Showtime, you know, which is a premium cable channel. I don't know if that was accurate or if that was called off or if there's still interest possibly from that side. I don't see DAZN as a game changer for MLW the way that an ESPN would be, clearly. So it's nice that they were able to get this deal. I mean, look, anything they can do, any kind of deal they can make to get more eyeballs on the product is nothing but a good thing. But here's the thing with DAZN. DAZN was said to have 8 million subscribers at the beginning of the year. This is pre-COVID, okay? 8 million subscribers, which is a lot more than the WWE Network has. Most of those, though, are from outside the United States. The number I saw for U.S. subscribers for DAZN was around 800,000 out of 8 million are from right here in the U.S. Now, what is DAZN? There was one article in the Sports Business Journal that referred to them, and maybe this is what they call themselves, I don't know, as the Netflix of sports. They have deals to air a lot of different sports. That's where the Bellator MMA shows air. Tons of other sporting events, live content. That's really what they built their business on. They built their business model on live boxing, big boxing fights that now aren't taking place because the world went to shit. They were in the news recently for telling sports leagues they would not be paying rights fees to them for any canceled games or canceled fights related to the pandemic. But the thing with DAZN, they've got to be desperate for content. Right? They've got to, I mean, look, FS1 and ESPN are the same way. They're probably desperate for content. That's why sometimes I'll be flipping around and I'll put ESPN on. And these video games now look so realistic. It takes me a few seconds for my eyeballs to adjust, because I'll put ESPN on and they're airing an NBA game and I'm like, oh, the NBA is back. Like it looks real. And then I see in the corner, I see one guy in the corner of the screen. I see another guy in the corner. They're playing a fucking video game. They are so desperate and starved for content and sports content that they have sports players playing video games on ESPN. And I'll bet that it's actually doing pretty good numbers too. FS1, like I said, FS1 has become like a second WWE network with all the wrestling that they're airing because they are desperate for content. For DAZN, though, they have built their entire business model on this live content that just is not there. And that, I'm guessing, has as much to do with them making a deal with MLW as anything else. Because without sports, what incentive is there for people to pay $20 a month to subscribe to DAZN? There was a Financial Times report recently that claimed that DAZN is desperately looking for ways to save money and stay in business, including just outright selling the company. There was a reporter with the New York Times a few weeks ago who claimed that they were losing hundreds of millions of dollars even before the pandemic. Imagine how much money they're losing now. I think instead of wondering, oh, you know, when will MLW be able to run live events again so they can air some of them on DAZN? The better question to ask may just be, will DAZN even exist by the time MLW starts running shows again? Some quick thoughts on NXT from this past Wednesday. They had a show-long storyline revolving around the Undisputed Era, Dexter Lumis, who was wrestling Adam Cole in the main event, non-title. And Roderick Strong is terrified of Dexter Lumis. He's looking, he sees Dexter, he would tell the guys, look, he's over there, and then they would cut, and of course he wouldn't be there. This is the benefit of doing these empty building taped shows. You can edit them like a horror movie. Although I see a horror movie every Monday night when I put USA on. But that was the show-long theme, the show-long storyline. Roddy is seeing things. Dexter is stalking them. Remember, he had kidnapped Bobby Fish and Roderick Strong at TakeOver and drove off with them in the trunk of his car. Apparently, earlier that day on Wednesday, they were released or they reemerged. I don't know why there isn't a warrant out for the arrest of Dexter Lumis on the charge of kidnapping, but in wrestling, it's kind of like their own little mafia. We handle things inside. We handle things internally. We don't got to get the authorities involved. We don't got to get the cops involved. I will say the creepy factor is very high with Dexter Lumis. I guess it means he's doing his job well. The guy he kind of freaks me out a little bit, which is the whole point. I think he does a good job with the character. And I've heard he's a good dude. Like, in real life, he's a cool guy, good dude, but just knows his character. We had a brief segment backstage with the Undisputed Era. They were in the back after that initial opening segment, and Keith Lee comes sauntering over. He had a match coming up next, and he looks at Adam Cole, and he looks down at the NXT Championship, and they were teasing that Keith Lee might be coming for that NXT title. It was very brief, and then Undisputed Era just walked off. But Keith Lee, I think, really ought to be in consideration for being the next in line. It doesn't look like he is, but he should be. He should be the next in line for an NXT title shot. Either him or Finn Balor. But like I said, it doesn't look like it's going to be either one of those guys. Keith Lee and Mia Yim, they lost to Johnny Gargano and Candice LeRae. Lee retained his North American title over Gargano at TakeOver, so this was, I guess, yeah, just a way to keep this going and give Gargano a win in a very kind of underhanded way. The finish I thought was amusing. Keith Lee hit the pounce to Johnny Gargano, sent him flying into Candice and into Mia Yim. They were going at it kind of on the apron. So Gargano collides, Candice goes down, Mia falls off the apron down to the floor. Keith Lee, very concerned about his lady, looks through the ropes, checking on her, making sure she's okay. As he's got, you know, his attention is diverted, Johnny Gargano comes over, catches him with a slingshot DDT. But Candice was down on the mat and Johnny just DDT'd this very large man right on top of his wife. Fell on her, Lee did, with all of his weight. So Candice was out, as any tiny woman or man would be if a 320-pound man landed on top of you. And Keith Lee felt bad. He picked her up. He picked her up Hogan style. Remember Hogan when he picked up Elizabeth after she took that wicked bump? Randy Savage got tossed out of the ring on the main event special back in 89. I think it was Akeem who threw Savage hard through the ropes, and Savage, like his hip, his leg just smashed right into Elizabeth. She took this great bump. She never took bumps. So this was a big deal. And when you watch it back, it was actually a pretty big bump. Hogan, the deceitful slime that he was at the time, picked up the Macho Man's wife, left the Macho Man to die in the ring with Big Boss Man and Akeem, and he carried Elizabeth to the back. Randy Savage had every right to be upset with Hulk Hogan. He left him in the ring to die. Why can't you go tell the Macho Man? The Macho Man can take his own wife to the back. The Macho Man was right. Hogan had lust in his eyes for Elizabeth. I'm telling you, he was a heel masquerading as a babyface. I've said this for years about Hogan. All American, say your prayers, right? You know, the Ten Commandments or whatever, right? Eat your prayers, say your, or whatever. That's what Hogan's mantra was. That's what he lived by. Do the right thing, be a good person. That was Hulkamania. He was a heel masquerading as a babyface. He would scratch people's backs. He would eye rake them. He would try to steal their wives. I'm telling you, he was a wolf in sheep's clothing for all those years that we just didn't know it. When you're a little kid, you don't know. Then you grow up, you be old enough, and you kind of see things for how they are. Anyway, Keith Lee kind of reminded me of Hogan picking up Elizabeth when he picked up Candace here. But when he picked up Candace's lifeless body, Gargano rolled him up from behind and pinned him. Did not seem the least bit concerned what his wife's condition was, even though she was down on the outside. This was not a setup. This was not like Candace popped up like, ha-ha, she was out. And the funniest part about this is Johnny, he's so happy that he won this match. He grabs her arm, which is just dead weight, and he's like waving it, like trying to celebrate with her even though she's unconscious. He was more concerned about celebrating his victory than his wife's physical condition. After a very good match with Finn Balor at In Your House, one that he lost, but this is one of the classic things where he won even in defeat. He looked good even in defeat. It appears now that Damian Priest is either a babyface or is going to be turned into a babyface. Cameron Grimes was in the back. He was talking shit. Overcame Damian Priest, popped him right in the mouth, right in the jaw. I'm down with that. I mean, I'm down with Damian Priest as a babyface. I think that could definitely work. Matt Riddle is moving to SmackDown. He was one of the bigger babyfaces on the NXT brand. Sounds like Dominik Dijakovic may be Raw bound, although now with these changes and Paul Heyman being out, who knows? Who knows if Dijakovic is being brought up to Monday Night Raw? Let Priest slide into that spot as a babyface. We got a squash win for Malcolm Bivens' tag team of Inda Share. Did not last long. I like the intensity that I saw from these guys. This reminded me of a classic tag team squash with two big guys that you would see on the syndicated shows 25 years ago, 30 years ago. You know, they won with their variation on the old demolition, speaking of 30 years ago. They won with a variation of the old demolition finish. And I know it kind of looked like they whiffed on a leg drop off the middle rope. They were not going for a leg drop. It kind of looked like it was, because I thought the same thing at first. I said, oh man, he missed him by like 6 inches. But then on the replay, he wasn't going for a leg drop. He just got a lot of height. It looked like he was leg dropping the guy. In fact, he dropped an elbow. And I think it was Rinku, and I think Surratt is the other one. And so they picked up a win. I think we need more Smash Mouth teams like this. But I liked what I saw here, actually. I liked what I saw here from these two guys, and Bivens as their manager. There's just a very old school vibe here. So I liked it. I liked it. We had a disheveled Robert Stone interrupting a Rhea Ripley promo in the back to make the pitch for her to join his brand. The Robert Stone brand. This is not some backhanded way to make fun of Vince Russo, is it? Because Vince Russo has the brand. I'm probably just reading too much into this. But they have made this guy and his brand look like a complete joke on television. So my mind starts to wander into conspiracy theory territory here. Is maybe this is some kind of inside joke. I don't know. But anyway, she said the chances of her joining were 1 in a million. He went all dumb and dumber on her and said, "So you're saying there's a chance?" And she took him aside, punched him in the gut, and then body slammed him into a garbage can. I guess that's his new gimmick now. Each week, he's going to get rejected by somebody new. Takes me back to my high school days. Finn Balor beat Cameron Grimes with a 1916 and then looked into the camera and called out Keith Lee and said that he, you know, has the North American Championship. The North American Championship is a title he never won. So it looks like Johnny Gargano is not yet done with Keith Lee. Finn Balor wants a piece of Keith Lee. We may be headed maybe for a triple threat. I don't know. Keith Lee and Finn Balor sounds like a fantastic pairing. I'd love to see that match. Johnny's no slouch, but he lost. Unless the idea is to build to a three-way where Lee doesn't have to be pinned to lose the belt. And that could be the way they get the championship back on Johnny Gargano. You know, maybe then that paves the way for Keith Lee to move on to bigger and better things. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe Keith Lee's going to be the one. You know, if Bruce Pritchard likes Keith Lee, he can bring him up to SmackDown. He can bring him up to Raw. Everything is up in the air right now. When you have a move like the one we saw this week where Paul Heyman, you know, the executive director of Monday Night Raw, is fired because they're not happy with the direction of the show, and they can end up blowing everything up, and then you don't know who's going to go where. Everything is up in the air right now. Maybe that would explain the very quick ascent that we now see with Karrion Kross, which I'll get to in a second. But the other, before I get to that though, the other big angle on the show, we had the new NXT Cruiserweight Champion, El Hijo del Fantasma, coming out to celebrate his championship win. Out comes Drake Maverick to congratulate him. He says, "You were the better man, you beat me for it." But then he goes, "I know I can beat you." He goes, "And if you would accept, if you would agree, he would love to have a rematch." And Fantasma, he's all smiles. "Of course, I'll give you a rematch." He's giving him a thumbs up. "Sure, of course." And then out come the two Lucha Ninjas. The guys in the suits with the Lucha masks on. They stop short. They're standing outside the ring. One's on one side, one's on the other. Maverick and Fantasma have their backs against each other, trying to stave these two guys off. And all of a sudden, Fantasma, he stops and he turns. And he stares down Drake Maverick until Drake turns around. And then Fantasma gives him a headbutt. And Fantasma and the two masked men, they start stomping the shit out of Drake Maverick. They're stomping a mud hole in this guy. And the masked men pull off their masks to reveal Raul Mendoza and Joaquin Wilde, former DJZ. Both men who were kidnapped by the Lucha Ninjas over the last few months. We haven't seen them since on TV, since they were kidnapped in the parking lot. And Fantasma hits the Phantom Driver on Drake Maverick, and then he pulls his own mask off. And he flips his hair up, and he reveals his new name. He goes, "I am Santos Escobar. I am the NXT Cruiserweight Champion, and no one can touch me." And then the other two hit stereo splashes to Drake Maverick. Like I said from the very beginning of this, and it's not like I'm some great prognosticator here, this should have been obvious to anybody watching, Fantasma was in on it the whole time. He was the one guy that these ninjas wouldn't put their hands on, or if they tried, they didn't get him, and he chased them away. The only guy. So you knew something was up here. You knew this was building to some kind of big reveal. I thought the actual reveal was kind of underwhelming, to be honest with you. This would have worked, this would have worked better in front of an actual audience. See, moments like this, when we look back on this pandemic period and the Performance Center and the empty Full Sail and everything, we're going to look back and we're going to have a lot of thoughts about this. But when we look back on this period, we're going to realize how many moments were spoiled. How many fun moments, even like the Otis and Mandy kiss at WrestleMania. Imagine that, paying that story off in front of 75,000 people. Probably have pyro going off in the sky. We're going to look back and say the biggest thing that we missed were moments like this, when you have a big turn or a big reveal or a big payoff or a big title win like Drew McIntyre, and not having a live audience there to react to it. That's going to be one of the biggest, that's maybe the biggest thing I'm going to miss. When I think of all the moments that were ruined or were underwhelming, it's like, man, that would have been so much better with people in the audience. And not just 20 people being told what to do, but actual people in the audience. So this, to me, just came across as being underwhelming. Unmasking Phantasma is fine. I mean, he was already unmasked, apparently, before in Mexico. You know, in Lucha Underground, when he was King Cuerno, he had a mask. But in Mexico, he was previously unmasked. It's not like he's never been unmasked before. Him speaking English at the end, I thought was great. I actually liked that we never really heard him speak much English. He was speaking in some broken English. And I was just thinking, like, I've heard that this guy is fluent in English. Why are they having him speak? You know, like, he's barely speaking any English up to this point. And instead, they saved it for this moment. So I kind of like that. The name change I could do without. There was nothing wrong with Phantasma. You can shorten it. It doesn't have to be El Hijo del Phantasma. It could just be Phantasma. I guess the name Phantasma, maybe that's tied into the mask, I guess. But I don't know. I just felt the name was fine. You know, the new name, I mean, Santos Escobar just sounds like one of those WWE names where they take two people's names and they just mash them together. Remember Kenny Dykstra? All right. I mean, obviously there was a New York Mets fan on the writing staff who said, hey, you know, I was a big Nails fan to Lenny Dykstra back in the day. Let's do Kenny Dykstra. Let's saddle this guy with the name Kenny Dykstra for the rest of his career. Someone here was watching Scarface, or he was watching what's the show on Netflix? Narcos. Someone was watching Narcos. Let's go with Escobar. We'll call him Santos. Santos Escobar. I hope there's no relation to Eric Escobar. The great Eric Escobar from SmackDown many years ago. That great run that he had. I'm being very facetious when I say that. I have no idea where he is or what he's up to. I hope he's doing well. Because he certainly didn't do well on SmackDown. Joaquin Wilde and Raul Mendoza as the Masked Men is confusing to me. Because who abducted them? Unless there's more Masked Men that we haven't seen yet. I mean, any more Masked Men, we're going to end up with Dark Order 2.0, and we don't need that. Aside from that making no sense, I like that they at least found a role for these two guys on the show. They now have their new heel faction. Maybe they're not going to be positioned at the very top, like Undisputed Era is, but it does make me wonder, you know, could this be a sign that we're seeing the final days of the UE on NXT? Now they have a new heel faction. You know, do we really need a second one? It's not like the NXT roster is that big to begin with. We'll see. I mean, the Undisputed Era to me has certainly run its course on NXT. If they were going to break them up, or if they were going to move them over to Raw, move them over to SmackDown, I don't think anybody would say, oh, it's not time yet. Give it more time. They've been doing their thing on NXT for years. How long has it been now for Adam Cole? I know Sami Zayn spent like 3 years in NXT on television before he went to the main roster. I feel like it's been that long or almost that long for Adam Cole at this point. I mean, unless he's going to be a lifer the way that Tommaso Ciampa wants to be a lifer, you know, at some point you gotta make the move. Although according to Road Dogg, maybe they shouldn't. He's not the size of Karrion Kross. He may not do so well. Dakota Kai had a match with Casey Catanzaro. We don't get to see Casey too often. Yeah, it was fine. Match was fine. Casey got to show off some of her flashy moves. Dakota beat her clean. Nice way, I guess, to give Dakota a win. She ate the pin. She took the losing fall at TakeOver, so she's back to her winning ways. Adam Cole. Adam Cole against Dexter Lumis. Lumis's movements, at least in this match, remind me a lot of The Undertaker when he first debuted in WWE. Those stiff movements, even on commentary, Beth Phoenix made mention of his stiff movements, reminded me exactly of The Undertaker from 1990, 1991, 1992. The only thing is, I say this, right? this guy moves around like The Undertaker in the early 90s. I say that, and then like 3 minutes later, the guy's doing a freaking swanton bomb or a senton off the top rope. This character is very bizarre. Very, very bizarre. Like, I half expect him to bust out a shooting star press in his next match. And then just slowly walk to the back. So Adam Cole got his knees up on that senton. Went for the Panama Sunrise. Loomis on the way down, though, caught him in that choke. It's like a, I guess, like a head and neck choke. Roddy, Fish, they get involved for the distraction. Cole hits the last shot, gets the pin. After the match, Loomis has Cole trapped again in the choke. Undisputed Era stomping away. Velveteen Dream, Velveteen Loser, comes out. And he goes after Roddy, and then he goes after Bobby. And Loomis chases Roddy all the way to the back. Roddy is scared to death. He goes running for the hills. And so that leaves Adam Cole in the ring all by himself, celebrating when all of a sudden the lights go out. And when the lights come back on, there's Scarlett at the top of the ramp. And she slowly walks down to the ring. And she pulls, you know, hiding behind her back, she pulls out this giant hourglass. And she sets it in the ring and the sand starts running down through it. I thought that was a cool little touch. Although, you know, he talks about TikTok. I thought maybe she'd have like a clock or something. But I guess the sands of time, that will work just as well. The sand, I guess, is representing, it's signifying that time is running out on Adam Cole as the NXT champion. So they're setting up Karrion Kross to be the next challenger for the NXT championship. And the question is it too soon? Kind of feels like it is. Reminds me of the Brian Cage thing in AEW. The guy just debuted. He won the casino ladder match. And now he's challenging for the AEW championship at Fighter Fest. He's wrestled nothing but scrubs on TV in the week since Double or Nothing. The pairing of him and Taz is brand new. And now he's going right to the top. And he's challenging Jon Moxley, and they've got a question to ask themselves. You know, do you change the title? Or do you beat this guy who just debuted? And now you're kind of seeing a similar situation possibly play out here on NXT. The difference I would submit to you is this. And I'm a Karrion Kross fan. I don't doubt for a second that he'll be the NXT champion, and I'd like to see him be the NXT champion. But when you're talking about, well, is it the same thing? Is it too soon? How come it's too soon for Brian Cage? Wouldn't it be the same thing for Karrion Kross? Here's the difference. Karrion Kross did get a win at TakeOver over a former NXT champion. He beat Tommaso Ciampa. Not only did he beat Tommaso Ciampa, he got a dominant win. He decisively, dominantly beat Tommaso Ciampa at In Your House. Practically a squash. I don't hate this, but I do think it is time, I think, for a babyface to get a run with that championship. You know, Johnny Gargano had a brief run with the NXT title that lasted not even a full 2 months. You know, when he won the title last year at TakeOver New York, it was not even a full 2 months before he lost it to Adam Cole. That reign was sandwiched. That babyface run for Johnny Gargano was sandwiched in between a Tommaso Ciampa reign that lasted about 8 months and an Adam Cole reign that has now lasted over a year. That would be my only reservation, that it might be time for a babyface. Maybe they turn Adam Cole. Maybe it's not going to be heel against heel. Maybe they have a babyface turn in mind for Adam Cole. Maybe that's going to play into the dissolution of Undisputed Era. Again, they could go any number of ways with this. They could go any number of ways with this if they wanted to. And Adam Cole is the kind of person, he could be, he's a, you know, a good heel, but I think he could be a great babyface too. In fact, he probably could be a better babyface even than a heel. And I say that as someone who does recognize that Cole is a smaller guy. And if he is going to eventually graduate to the main roster, I look at Daniel Bryan as a great blueprint where Daniel Bryan got over as the sympathetic babyface. And I think if Adam Cole was ever going to catch fire and get over to that level, it would be a lot easier for him to get over at that level, I think, as a babyface or as somebody who, you know, can take a beating and fights back and can get sympathy from the audience. Because Adam Cole, you know, the one thing I will say, to go back to what Road Dogg said in that interview, Adam Cole, he is a smaller guy. I don't look at Adam Cole and think, oh, what a badass. Adam Cole is not going to come to TV and walk around like he's some, you know, BMF, like when Austin would walk around with BMF on his vest. Adam Cole ain't walking around with a vest that says BMF. And if he did, nobody would believe it. Because that's not who Adam Cole is. He is not a badass. So it could be that he would thrive more so in that role and be more believable in that role, coming from underneath. Yes, he's in the ring with guys that are bigger and tougher than him, but man, this guy's fucking awesome. He can find so many different ways to beat you. He's scrappy, he's resilient, he can fight from underneath. I see him having more success, frankly, in that role, I think, if and when he initially comes to the main roster. But is that going to happen now or in the next couple of months? I don't know. Like I said, everything is up in the air. Creatively, in this company right now, everything is up in the air. And if anybody tells you they know exactly what's going to happen, they're lying to you. Because I'm sure these decisions are only being made right now. But Karrion Kross is going to be a star. You don't need me to tell you that. I'll tell you that anyway. He's going to be a star. Once they get people back into these buildings, the guy's got Scarlet. The guy's got that entrance. It won't be long before he gets cheered anyway. Karrion Kross will go on to be one of the biggest baby faces in NXT before all is said and done. This Wednesday, we have two tag team title matches. Imperium defends against Breezango, which should be an Imperium win. And whoever the women's tag team champions are coming out of Backlash tonight will come to Full Sail to defend against Tegan Nox and Shotzi Blackheart. Like I said earlier, during the predictions for Backlash that I ran down, it should be Sasha and Bayley retaining tonight, I hope. And then they go on to defend against Tegan and Shotzi on Wednesday, and I would do the title change. I would give them to Tegan and Shotzi, let them run with it, let them defend it on NXT, have a few defenses on Raw and SmackDown, get the audience a little familiar with who they are. Why not? Why can't it go both ways? Charlotte Flair came to NXT, right? Oh, Charlotte Flair is going to be in NXT and give NXT a boost. Credibility boost, a ratings boost. Didn't quite work out that way. Why can't the opposite be true? Why can't we have an act from NXT that makes a few appearances on Raw and makes a few appearances on SmackDown and gets their faces out there? And at least then it's something different. It's something a little bit out of the box to do with the women's tag team titles as opposed to just, you know, putting them back on Alexa and Nikki or putting them on the Iconics. So we're right around 2 hours. That's a good place to stop. I want to get this out as early as possible because there is a pay-per-view tonight. And we are talking about predictions here at the beginning of the show. So I will save the RSPW Rewind and some mailbag questions for next week. If you've missed any of the content, by the way, that I've put out, there's been a lot of content. Some of which I push to the feed, not all of it. Do subscribe to the YouTube channel so that way you will get notifications when new content goes up. If I go live, I'm going to watch Undertaker Chapter 4 later today. I will have a review for it Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern on the YouTube channel. There's only two episodes left in the documentary series. So my Chapter 4 review will be on YouTube Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Of course, I'll be live on YouTube tonight. As soon as Backlash goes off the air, we'll recap the entire show, including quite possibly the greatest wrestling match ever. What a joke. But we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. It should be a very good match. I don't know that they can top Daniel Bryan and AJ Styles from Friday night. If they can top that match, then it'll be an excellent match. But it will not be the greatest match of all time. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. I'll be live tweeting during the show tonight as well. And yeah, that's all I got. I will see you live tonight. We're going to be giving away 3 championship belts. So go to WrestleRumble.com before 7 o'clock tonight. It's only $1. Get in on this. Get in on this giveaway. And tonight I'm going to pick 1 winner at random live during the stream on YouTube to get all 3 replica belts. Thank you for the support. Be well. Stay safe. And I'll see you live on YouTube tonight for the Backlash recap and back here for 657 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Viking Raiders driving in their car while Ivar chowed down on a giant drumstick. Because I guess to WWE, that's what all Vikings do. I ordered Popeyes the other day. I don't want a wing. You know, breasts are good too. Nothing wrong with breasts. but the drumsticks are where it's at. I chowed down on a nice drumstick from Popeyes the other day. Does that make me a Viking too?
The Salamonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Salamonster on Twitter @Salamonster.
Salamonster.
Salamonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Salamonster Sounds Off.